And now we're going to focus on some of the case studies for some of the CZOs, we'll roll through those. And the first one we'll have will be the case study of the Southern Sierra CZO. And Yael Hoffman will be here from the University of California, Davis, to give us some context and background on that site. And I'll give you a 5-minute warning. I'll go off this for 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. I was actually volunteered to give this presentation, and I was really very excited about it until I found out my excitement was a little damped that I found out I was in an S5 session. So now I had to rethink a little bit my talk, but I got good help from Toby Eugene, actually, and we spent some time together. So hopefully, and we put this CGO observatory in a pedology context, and clearly, as we, to have pedology in critical zone is very critical, right? So we all agree with that. The critical zone observed in the Southern Sierras was one of the first three that were funded a few years ago, and we focused broadly in three different areas. One was to have a better basic understanding of surface and subsurface flow. The second one was to better understand ecosystem function in these forested watersheds, realizing that the observatory is at between 5,000 and 7,000 feet, and it's always in its transition from rainfall dominated to snow dominated. And the third part is indeed the weathering processes and all of these and how they are affected possibly by climatic change. The critical zone, the Southern Sierras, is located, let me see over here if I can see that, right over here. It's called the Kings River Experimental Watershed. It's between the Yosemite and Kings Canyon, Sequoia's Kings Canyon National Park. It really has been very successful. It's kind of like a breeding ground, I think, in terms of collaborations. We have about eight different institutions that are working on the Southern Sierra, and many scientists working, and continually encourage scientists to work with in the CGO and visit the site and find a project that can complement what we are doing. Just a few characteristics of the site. Elevation, like I said, is between 5,000 and 7,000 feet. It's a mixed conifer zone in the forest in the California Sierra Nevada with about 80% coverage. And very productive forest. I mean, these trees are 50 meters and higher. And that's actually one of the questions we have, how that can happen in this limited, seemingly limited system. Precipitation is a mix of snow and rain, so it's in the transition zone, so potentially very, very sensitive to climatic changes in terms of temperature and precipitation, which varies roughly between a meter and 2 meters between years, but surprisingly independent of elevation. In terms of the fraction of that falls as snow is between 75 to 90% at the higher and only 35 to 60 at the lower elevations. So the Kings River Experimental Watershed really is three small watersheds, catchments, and you see them over here, size ranging from 50 hectares to 10 square kilometers, a lot of instrumentation. The P301, a lot of the data that we are presenting and very much we focus on this one. That we have a flux tower over here. This is an embedded sensor network. We have an upper meteorological station and a lower one. They're about 1,000 feet apart. And there's a lot of more instrumentation that we have in these catchments. And you see some of that in my presentation. In terms of source characteristics, it's pretty much a granodiorite and granitic diorite. It's weakly developed. Really, it's very young soils. They come, smaller, less than 15,000 years. So there is not too many changes, subtle changes in texture, origination, and so on. There really are two main types, relatively speaking, and depend on elevation. The higher elevation, colder, has been, it's glaciated, it's glacial scouring, so the soil profiles are pretty shallow, less than a meter mostly. And so sands and loamy sands are the predominant texture. And if you go lower, we have more the loams, the coarse sandy loams, thicker horizons and deeper soils. Still, pretty shallow, but mostly, below 1 meter and in the absence of glacial activities. So this slide shows really the differences in texture in general between high and low elevation, the upper, you know, south and north slope and lower, you know, south and north slope. And clearly, you know, in terms of texture, the coarser materials at the higher elevations, and in fact, we see more clay at the lower elevations. And we see the same with, in the profile with, you know, with depth. So if the deeper you go, more rock, more sand, and decrease in clay. We tried to, with Toby and others, and Dylan is here, I think, you know, putting this depth to the bedrock map together. And so, you know, you see here the three little watersheds, 1, 2, 3. Again, you know, we use them. It's fairly weakly developed soils, so that most of the soils are around 1 meter or shallower, but we only were able to observe at less than 1 meter. So there is some gaps there. We used a regression tree to do that. There were about 230-240 observations, but again, limited to 1 meter depth. We used a linear regression model, which includes surface slope, vegetation, density, and tree occurrence. But you know, you notice the although the structure, the general trends were very well mapped, because of the very small scale variations, only the model accounted for 16% of the variance. And Toby wanted me to point out that indeed, you know, the circle data are really coarsely mapped for these areas, so there's not much help there. And clearly, you know, for hydrologic modeling, you know, we need much better information about depth to bedrock, because that's really one of the drivers of flows. Among the various science questions, and some of them, and they were shown here, the first one was really how we, that we are looking at is the linkage between soil moisture and landscape position. And for that, we actually, we deployed a network of soil moisture sensors at two different elevations, like the upper and the lower, and we really were looking at soil moisture and snow depth at different positions relative to the three position, so under the canopy, at a drip edge, and in the open position, and so we had in total we had about 14 tree locations where we had soil moisture measurements at different depths. So we had an enormous amount of soil moisture information over a few years, and you see here the different type of locations and that we selected. So upper and lower elevation, north and south slope, different tree species. You see the dominant tree species listed over here. And we also measure snow depth, and you see over here, you know, kind of the snow depth fingers, you know, under the canopy at the drip edge and open. So this slide is just basically a placeholder, but really what it shows is the enormous variability that we found in soil moisture. And so at first sight, after looking at all these data, it was, you know, what is the problem here? These sensors are not working. By the way, we used the echo sensors, and we did a lot of calibration, and we felt pretty comfortable with it, that we found all this variability. And by the way, this is 2 years, you know, so the higher is in the winter and spring, and so there's snow melting, and in between, you know, the water contents going down is going into the spring and in the summer and late fall. And so, and the peaks are really, in this case, correspond with melting events, okay, during the winter. So why this variability? And so what, you know, and we think there is indeed a lot of, you can explain a lot of the variability, and these are the few slides that they show here. You know, particularly, for example, these are shallow soils, there's a lot of saprolite there, and the saprolite has very, very low porosity. And so when you put these sensors in the saprolite, you know, you find very low water content, despite that there is a lot of drainage going on. And so that was clearly one of the observations and conclusions we got out of that. Also, like I said before, in terms of elevation, there is really a big difference between higher and lower elevation that relates to soil texture. So what we found, and that's what you see here over the 2 years, you know, that the lower elevations, finer materials, significantly higher water content, and soil moisture storage in the lower elevation, it was very significant. And here you see an example of looking at the averages between the two, in terms of soil moisture storage between the two elevations. So this is a list of different explanations that we really are physical explanations of the variations in soil moisture, and most of them I have mentioned. Soil litter and diff layers, organic layers, is another reason that we can, you know, that explains some of the variations. And then, of course, there's a lot of preferential flow that, you know, depending on the position of the landscape, that water actually would run along the bedrock away from or converging near trees. And then there's, of course, the more, the ones here in the end, that relate to the hydrology of and the effect of the tree itself and canopy and root water uptake on soil moisture. Okay, the science questions that we ask ourselves, and that's what we are heavily involved with, is really looking at ecosystem function of these forested ecosystems. And I'm just going to show you a few slides. I know I just don't have enough time to show all this, but the way we decided to do that is to monitor individual trees. Okay, so this is one of the close to one of the trees, you see the big flux tower there, which is 50, 60 meter tall, and where we do, all the instrumentation and eddy covariance and so on. You see some of the characteristics of the one of the watersheds, the P301, where we do a lot of that monitoring. So here you see a slide that shows one example. This is a white fir tree, and we have, just looking at the left-hand side over here, you see this tree here, we put in all these sensors, soil moisture, temperature, water potential sensors. You see over here, in terms of, you can look at it as a spoke of a wheel, where we look at 12 different directions, different spokes, where we install all these sensors up to about 5 to 6 meters away from the trunk. And you see here on the top, the tree at the time, with, of course, there's no power there, so everything is solar panel powered. We have a camera there that provides real-time information. 5 minutes only. I need to go on, so I'm gonna. So here you see there some results of the tower of the video camera. Here you show variations in soil moisture storage, and I show you the numbers here that we can use this to actually get temporal changes in root water uptake (ET) in millimeters per day. A lot of detailed information at very small, fine time and space scales. So I'm gonna skip this. The reason we all do this is we want to model the hydrology of these trees. And so we actually look at the tree as a porous medium as we do for the soil. We couple the two together and we actually model the flow and the hydrology of water and through the tree. And so we are right in the middle of that. And with that, for example, we can simulate sap flows through the tree trunk and how it varies along with height in the tree. And you see here a comparison of observations. So this is a slide I was showing before. So we actually do a lot of tree measurements. We put sap flow, we measure water potential, leaf water potential in the tree. We're also going to expand these measurements, and we need more ecology, more people physiology in there. We want to look at canopy temperature and how it's distributed in multiple dimensions. But one of the interesting things is to track how ET by comparing what the sap flow is versus the soil moisture, and we find in general this is pretty good matching, and you see the graph over here. However, when we do a watershed balance, actually we find that these trees take a lot of more water, as we think we can measure here, and so the speculation is, and we hear that many times, and it might be correct, is that these tree roots go much deeper, they go into the saprolite, they might go in fractures in rocks, and so on. So the idea was, aha, let's find out. So we took one of the trees very close to the one that was instrumented, and you see the graph that shows sap flow for that particular tree until we cut it. And so you see a decreasing sap flow. So we are, it's just 3 weeks ago, okay, 3-4 weeks ago, we cut the tree, and we started exposing the root system. And for that, we use what's called an air knife. Actually, we use a couple of them, and we systematically start removing soil. And okay, you see a series of 8 or so slides, how this is progressing, okay? So here we just started, so we excavated about between 10 and 20 centimeters at this point, okay? So here we are the next one. So here we are about 50 centimeters, you start seeing this root mat. Okay, this root mat is all over, okay? It doesn't matter what the tree is. If you start exposing it, there's this root mat that's all over the surface. And you see that very clearly over here. So here we are about at 2 feet, and this really shows the root distribution of the top 2 feet, okay? And so what I'm saying is whether we are here or here would not make any difference. This really, the whole forest floor, we believe, has this root mat. And sometimes you see that some of these trees, these roots from other trees are invading in this particular tree space, okay? Now we go deeper, and so, we are interested, so we take knives, we cut down these finer roots because we want to go deeper, and that's what you see started over here. So we're looking at the architecture of these main roots, these primary roots. Okay, so we are here at 1 meter, now we go deeper. You see here there are 4, 5, 6 people that are working on this for a whole week. And so now you see them snipping away, the finer roots. And so we're here now at about 1.50 meters, and see what the architecture of these trees are. And these are, we believe, fairly representative of what's going on. We go under there because we want to see whether these main roots can actually go further down, okay? Because it are these main roots that would have laterals and secondary and so roots with them. And so what did we find? They don't. So there is this separate interface, you know, which is about 1.50 meters. In this case, it will vary where you are in the landscape, but in this case, it was about that depth. And you see these stems of the roots. The roots cannot go in there. It becomes very consolidated over here. Okay, you see some of the laterals start pulling away and actually can go a little deeper, but mostly, you know, once you go deeper, and that's what you see over here, you know, so here we're a little bit away from the tree trunk, the main architecture, and the finer roots. This is about 5 meters away from the tree. You know, you see these finer roots, and the same thing. They go, and there are quite a few of them, and they can come from many trees, but they hit this subrock, and they don't go further. It's very consolidated. I'm not a pedologist, but really, what we found was there is a lot more work that needs to happen in this zone to better understand what's going on. So what we're doing is we're taking this root system, and we are imaging it. So we're using LiDAR, portable LiDAR, and we did that. This figure is not the one of this tree, but this is from a colleague in Davis. We actually did the imaging, and we hope to have images in the next few weeks to show really, you know, in 3D how these roots are distributed. My last slide. So after all of this, you know, I sat down a few days ago and said, well, what have we learned from this, okay? So we put this slide together that shows pictorially, you know, how the system looks like. And you see the weathering sequence that, you know, from the top down, you know, the bedrock. We came to about 2 meters, okay? We didn't actually hit the granite, but it was very close. You saw the color changed from reddish to gray. The trees really are not, the roots are not going much deeper than 1.50 meters. That's where they hit that interface. Okay, you see there is a lot of interwoven roots over here. Then there's the saprolite, and then it goes into the saprock, which is really very consolidated. Okay, the roots are not going in there. Also what we believe, and this is speculation to some extent, is, but I think for you very familiar, there is weathering going on, that, and the rate of weathering depends on the tree location. And so in the root system, at least that's what we observed, you know, more weathering. And you see these depressions, you know, in the, where the main roots are. You know, there's physical weathering, obviously, but there is, you know, chemical weathering. There is the increasing acidity and so on. And so there is actually deeper soils, you know, locally. These, we believe, maybe serve as depressions, and actually, and this is not correct, fully correct, but there is topography here as conversions for water that flows subsurfacely in these depressions. You can imagine, right? So the water flows to the deep, to where it is deep, and it's impermeable over here. So the water collects, and actually that might be one of the explanations we think that could explain why these trees are doing so well over there. This is very limited, okay? There is no rain, by the way, you know, from April, May to October, November, okay? And these soils are shallow, so the main question is really how come these forests, these trees are so productive? Thank you. Yeah. Well, again, you know, no, we haven't. I say, Toby, you need to come. Okay, and he says, well, you know, I have no time today. You know, so, but he's going to come with me, and we're going to look at this a little bit more and get a better description. I don't think we saw evidence of mycorrhizae, as what you indicate. But, you know, again, this is not our area. We need more expertise to look at those things. Well, it's not, I bought the air knife because there are arborists, you know, companies that do that. This costed, yeah. This is just, you know, you pull out your pocket, right? I mean, and aside from, you know, it's $10,000 to do this. And actually the imaging costs another $2,000 or $3,000. So you have to be careful. So there is some other funds that you pull to make that work. Yeah.